Hello, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to the next of the Little Atoms Road Trip podcasts. The annual conference of the Orange County Freethought Alliance is being held at the University of California, Irvine, over the weekend of May the 19th and the 20th, 2012. It's Saturday, May the 19th. I'm here in Orange County, California, and I've spent the day at the conference taking in some of the talks and chatting to some of the speakers for this podcast. There are 5 short interviews coming up, talking about various aspects of atheism and skepticism in the USA. And first up is Richard Carrier. Richard Carrier is an American historian. He writes for various secular websites such as Internet Infidels. As an advocate of atheism and metaphysical naturalism, he has published articles in books, journals and magazines, and also features on the documentary film The God Who Wasn't There, where he is interviewed about his doubts on the historicity of Jesus. His most recent book is Proving History, Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus. So I'm talking to Richard Carrier right now. Richard, please tell us about yourself and why you're here at this conference today.
Yes, I'm a historian and philosopher, have many books and am known around the country and beyond. And this is the kind of thing I do, go to conventions and talk about my ideas and my publications and the things I've found in both philosophy and ancient history. And that's my story. And you can learn more about me at richardcarrier.info.
So you're a historian by trade, and you're involved with skeptical websites such as the Internet Infidels, and one of your specialities is the historicity of Jesus.
That's right.
So let's talk about that first.
Sure. Yes, the most controversial issue. Yes. Yeah, right away.
So, did he exist?
I think more probably he did not, but I don't think we can be certain. I think this is one of the, especially for the first century and for early Christianity, our source situation, our document situation is really piss poor. It's terrible. So there's a lot of things we don't know. There's a lot of uncertainties. So I'm not absolutely certain. But I think when we look at all the evidence we do have, the non-existence of Jesus actually makes more sense of all of the evidence. But only one particular kind of theory of that. There's a lot of like bogus, baloney theories of why Jesus didn't exist. We call them mythicist theories. A lot of different Jesus myth theories that are terrible, or they're based on conspiracy theories and factual errors and all kinds of like leaps of logic and so on. But no, they're actually more sober, plausible, contextually sensible explanations of how Christianity began that don't involve that.
Well, to put that into context then, just give us one of the examples of the crazy conspiracy theory.
The craziest, there's this guy, I can't remember his first name, but Atwill is his last name, an author. I think he wrote this book called Caesar's Messiah or something like that. But his argument is that Christianity was a deliberate invention of the Roman Empire to try and control the Jews, and then it got out of hand, and that the whole New Testament is forged by this cabal of Roman elites. And he even tries to identify who they are in the literary culture of the time, and that Josephus was in on it, and that whoever wrote the writings of Josephus and the New Testament were the same person, and that they left clues, secret clues that you can find out, that you can
it's
see,
like the Da Vinci Code.
Right? Yeah, exactly. That tell you that they're based on each other. Ridiculous. Yeah. There's others that Christianity was conceived in the second century by a cabal of monks in Alexandria. It's another crazy theory. But there's a variety of these different ideas. And some of them are that core plausible, but they heap on a bunch of other assumptions that are not. Or they get the facts wrong. Like, for example, one of the core tenets of mythicism is that there was this whole mytheme at the time, in centuries coming up to Christianity, of the dying and rising Savior God. This idea of a Savior God who dies in some sense, rises from the dead in some sense, and then through that you can gain personal salvation, individual salvation. And we know, if we can document that this mytheme existed. We have definite cases of this. However, there's a lot of people who will claim that certain gods fit this mytheme that do not. Mithras is an example. We have no evidence that Mithras, of Mithraism, we have no evidence that he was a dying and rising God. That he underwent some sort of struggle, and it was called a passion, just like for Jesus. He underwent some sort of torment or struggle through which he gained victory over death. So there is a common theme there, but it wasn't his own death that did it. It was something else, and we're not really sure because the Gospels of Mithras don't survive, although we have a picture version of it. We have kind of like a picture Bible for Mithraism without the text, so we can kind of get an idea of what was going on. But so a lot of these bad mythicists will include Mithras among the dying and rising gods, and even make absurd claims like that he initiated a Eucharist ceremony where he said, "Eat this bread, it's my body. Drink this wine, it's my blood." That never occurred. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of false claims floating around that make my job harder, because I want to take it in a serious direction. Let's talk about what the evidence actually is. But I keep getting painted with, the people will read this crap stuff and say, well, you're just like them. Like, no, I'm trying to do it right. I'm trying to do it correctly. Yeah. So that's the difference.
So let's talk a little bit about early Christianity then, because clearly, there is this thing called Christianity that exists, and it obviously started somewhere. If
that's
there's
right.
doubt that the person that it was based on didn't exist, where did it start?
Well, we have evidence, and for example, at the same time that Christianity began, there's this Jewish philosopher Philo in Alexandria, Egypt. In his writings, we have evidence that there was a Jewish belief before Christianity that there was this celestial being who was the firstborn son of God. He was actually like the first Superman created before Adam, and he was kind of like a parallel Adam in outer space. And he was called the Logos, just like Jesus is in the Gospel of John. He was called the high priest in the heavens of the heavenly temple versus the earthly temple, just like the book of Hebrews says of Jesus. And his name was Jesus. Now, so there's already this belief of this celestial Jesus figure who fits all of the criteria of early Christianity. So when we're looking in the writings of Paul, the authentic letters of Paul, for example, his only sources of information that he ever actually references, that he says this is where we learn these things, are revelations, visions of this celestial Jesus, or Scripture. They find secret messages in Scripture. But if those are their only sources, it seems to be that this is what's happened, that they're having visions, communications from the celestial Jesus, who's telling them that he underwent this sort of dying and rising ceremony in outer space, and that this is how the religion began, and they learned all of this through visions and revelations. And over time, over the decades, they would create a myth that put him on Earth and had him do these things on Earth and so forth. And we know that happened to other gods, like Osiris, for example. They created myths that put him on Earth in a particular historical period. They're not true, but nevertheless, they wrote them. Romulus is another god where they did this, too. We have a lot of examples of this. So it fits in context. It's the kind of thing that could have happened. And so it's just a question of looking at, does the evidence support that? Does that theory make more sense of the evidence? And I think ultimately it does.
Okay, finally then, during this trip, I'm trying to look at science and skepticism and atheism, particularly from an American perspective. As I'm sure you're well aware, things are somewhat different in Europe and the UK. And if we were sitting here having this conversation in London, we'd be talking about what you were writing as, a work of scholarly history, and there'd almost be no controversy about it.
But right.
how is your work received here is the point I'm trying to get to.
It's hard to say because there's so many different communities that receive it in different ways. Even in the atheist community, it gets mixed reception. There's certainly a large contingent of atheists who are very excited about it and want to read this work because they're confident that I am doing it correctly in the way that hasn't been done in the past, and so they've actually been looking for that. And that's actually how I ended up doing it, is that a lot of my fans actually got together a grant to pay me to do this. Like, so we want you to do it right because there's a lot of interesting stuff here, but a lot of wishy-washy stuff. We want to see it done correctly, and no one else is doing it, so they sort of created this grant to make it happen. But then there are a lot of atheists who think we're making things harder for them, because they think, well, why don't we just argue that Jesus was an ordinary man? If you're going against the mainstream in this way by saying he doesn't exist, you're making atheists look crazy, and it's like this. So why don't we just avoid doing that, which I think is more of a political motive rather than, as a historian, I find it a fascinating, interesting question. I want to know what the truth is, and I want to properly analyze the evidence to show this. So to me, I'm not thinking of politics about how it's going to affect things. I just want to know what the truth is and make a serious scholarly argument, bring it to the scholarly community. And that's the thing that can't be gauged yet, because I published Proving History, which is Bayes' theorem in the quest for the historical Jesus, which sets up the method and basically shows that the methods that have been used to study Jesus are bankrupt, and there are many scholars who have agreed with this already, and I document that. And then said, what method do we need to replace it with? And then the next book, which will come out in 2013, will be on the historicity of Jesus Christ, and that will be the first publication that's taken a serious PhD-level scholarly analysis of the evidence to see. So the reception of the theory among academia can't be gauged yet because the book hasn't come out yet, really, or the book that they need to read hasn't come out yet. That's still waiting in the wings.
So you're doing talks like this, which is to a skeptical community, but no doubt you also do talks where the audience is more mixed. And of course, you're talking about, say, the person who's the core of a lot of people's firmly held beliefs doesn't exist. So how do those people tend to receive?
It varies by the type of Christian audience, because the more liberal Christian audience think I'm wrong, but are at least interested in hearing the story.
Yeah.
The conservative Christians thinks it's all bunk, and would probably not want to listen to me talk about it. They'd want me to debate it. Like, they'd want to see a fight, this little entertaining battle between me and some Christian apologist over it. That hasn't happened yet. I don't usually get asked by conservative Christian groups to come speak about this topic, although that may happen coming forward as my publication on this stuff becomes more known and so forth. forth. There may be like the Evangelical Philosophical Society might have a panel and ask me to like come defend your view, and then that'll be interesting. I'm curious to see how that goes, but that hasn't happened yet. But usually, when I'm presenting these ideas to mixed like Christian groups of different liberal persuasions, they're skeptical, but they're at least willing to hear it out, and they find some of it interesting. So it's not like a totally hostile reaction.
Richard, that was great. Thanks very much. So just tell us quickly again the most recently published book.
Proving History, Bayes' Theorem, and the Quest for the Historical Jesus.
Fantastic. Thanks. The next interview is with Aaron Ra. Aaron Ra is one of the YouTube atheists, an internet activist and advocate of rationalism in science education. His videos usually focus on phylogenetics with an emphasis on countering creationist claims. I'm speaking to Aaron Ra. Aaron, thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You're a communicator of science and rationalism, focusing on evolution and specifically phylogenics and cladistics, which we'll talk a little bit more in detail about in a moment. But tell us, first of all, you have a really interesting backstory. Tell us how you got involved in this in the first place.
Well, there's probably a number of interesting backstories on this. I live in Texas, which is overrun by the religious right, and the political situation there has long been a matter of international embarrassment, what with our school board and our governor, and the former governor became president, and the fiascos that resulted from that. But on a more particular note, I mean, once upon a time, I was talking with this charming young lady in South Texas who was very offended by the fact that I was wearing a Darwin Fish T-shirt, and she said, "You can't prove evolutionism."
Evolutionism.
Yeah, and so I told her I actually could explain the position in a compelling way, and that I couldn't. She wanted me to do it right then and there, and I said, "Well, I can't quite give you a whole college education required to do this right here and now, but I will come up with a compressed, concise explanation for this." And I did, and I came up with the Foundational Falsehoods of Creationism series. And unfortunately, I sent her links to the first half dozen of them. And she wrote me back saying that I was hurting people.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I'm imagining that moment where she goes, "Oh, yeah, you're right. You have convinced me." So bearing that in mind, you have this YouTube channel where you produce videos talking about evolution and phylogenics and so on. So who are they primarily aimed at then? Who do you expect the audience to be?
Well, for the most part, I expect it to be people that are on the fence, people that are investigating, people that care whether their perspective is based on or relative to reality. I recently had a confrontation at the Reason Rally, famously, with the pair of guys that were Ray Comfort supporters, and one of them, I sent him a challenge, an email, once he established contact with me afterward. I said, "I want you to answer the question for me of whether it is more important to you that you understand the way things really are, or that you get to believe whatever you want to believe, regardless of whether or not they're true." And I said, "How you answer that question will determine whether this conversation continues." Mm-hmm. A lot of people will answer that question in one way or another to the effect that these may be what the facts are, but I prefer to believe this. And so religion is, in that respect, a matter of pretend. Mm-hmm. Those people I'm not going to reach. Mm-hmm. Reason is not going to reach those people. But most people don't defy their own natural curiosity. Most people, when confronted with a conflict, with a contradiction, when they realize they are wrong about something, they don't force themselves to believe it anyway. Most people are receptive to the truth. Even if it is uncomfortable, mm-hmm. they'll still accept it. So the people in my audience consist partly of the people that are trying to learn more about science, partly about people that are trying to be more activist in atheism. But for the most part, it's simply people who care what the truth is. Because to a large degree, religious people, you know, although they always use the word truth with a capital T, what is really true is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. They assert as fact that which is not evidently true. They believe things in spite of evidence, and they follow the confirmation bias. And all of the creationist organizations that I am aware of have a statement of faith wherein they announce in advance that they will automatically reject any and all evidence that stands against them, and that you couldn't be any more dishonest than that. For these people, truth is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. My audience is just people that are honest.
I'm really interested to talk about what the appeal of that creationism, that sort of biblical literalism is. I come from Europe, and the mainstream church in Europe, and of course in the US, fully accepts evolution, fully accepts the geological age of the Earth. So where does that impulse of the biblical literalism come from, do you think?
Well, a lot of it is really, it's most religious beliefs, at least in Texas, and I think this is much broader than just what I find myself surrounded by. These people use their religious convictions as a means of escaping responsibility. Whatever evil you have done, you can pretend that something will forgive you if you just believe hard enough. Likewise, climate change denial, they're following the same thing. They don't want to be responsible for the fossil fuels that they're burning because we live in Texas and we're dependent on fossil fuels. We don't allow electronic cars anymore, and we're not going to do anything green, damn it. We're going to continue driving our 1969 Chevy Chevelle 454 with the dual quads, and we're not going to stop because we want to do what we want to do, and we don't want to be responsible when shit goes bad. And we could have fixed it, but the environment is a much harsher situation than anybody's individual life or what criminality you might be responsible for that you want want forgiveness for. When you get into the environment, the questions are much harder, the answers are much harder, and it scares people. Anybody reasonable is going to look at the environment and the environmental situation. They're going to look at the big picture, and they're going to realize that something needs to be done. And the climate change denialists, as much as the religious people, and for the same reasons, want to deny any responsibility, keep doing what they want to do, and pretend that it doesn't matter. Jesus is going to come back and destroy the planet anyway. We need to bring more souls unto the Lord. So what if we can't feed the people that are already here? We need to have 10 more. We need to have another baby every year. You know, we need to have multiple wives. We can make multiple more babies every year. And we need to fish the planet out until it can't sustain itself anymore. And we need to cut down every tree and burn up all the oil that has been here for tens of millions of years, because fuck the future generations who might have a better use for it. There's not going to be a future generation. We don't have to be responsible for what we leave to our grandchildren, because Jesus is coming back. And so I get to do what I want to do, and I don't have to have any responsibility for that.
I mean, that's clearly the case with the creationists, but one of the things that surprised me today at this conference is that actually that schism exists in the skeptical community as well. I was quite surprised to see that there are, you know, there are people within this community who also, you know, don't want to do anything about it.
It's surprising. And when I meet, here's a sad thing. I know atheists who are not skeptics in the least. I know atheists who won't admit that they're atheists. A lot of them. They want to choose some other word. You know, they'll use some strange excuse that, you know, well, I'm not convinced that there's a God, but I'm not convinced that there's not a God either. Well, that means you're not convinced that there's a God. That means you're atheist. But they don't accept that. They want to be completely noncommittal. Now, in that group, these same people will also hold to beliefs in spiritualism, non-deific spiritualism. Maybe it's shaman, maybe it's Taoist, maybe it's Chinese ancestor worship or whatever it is, but they believe in some sort of spirituality, supernatural elements, pyrotechnics, psionic mind capabilities or what have you, homeopathy. They believe in all of this bullshit. They just don't happen to believe in a God. So rejecting a religion does not mean you're a skeptic. And likewise, I know that there are religious people who claim to be skeptics, and I don't understand that either, because if you're going to be skeptic, then that should be the first thing I think that would generally go, is the whole idea about a devil and a God, and that any man in a dress in Europe actually knows what the hell he's talking about when he makes these kind of proclamations. When they arbitrarily decide that purgatory no longer exists because the Pope said so, or that they have a new list of 7 more deadly sins, as if the first 7 wasn't enough. So, and who makes up these rules? You know, and okay, so God has a lot of afterthoughts that he has to visit to people, and he only visits them to individual people, and he makes sure that the revelation that he gives this guy contradicts the revelation that he gives this guy, and none of these guys can figure out what the hell's wrong. And why are 2 guys both saying that Jesus told them opposing comments? And why is it that we have 6 guys running for president because God told each one of the 6 guys to run for president? Nobody sees a contradiction in this.
Let's finish off spending some time talking about cladistics then. So, why have you chosen this approach?
When you look at evolution and you realize that, you know, that most people don't understand phylogenetics. No, most people don't understand taxonomy. And to me, there is no greater evidence of evolution than that. I mean, you want to say that we evolved from, we didn't evolve from apes, but we are apes. You want to say we didn't evolve from monkeys, but you know what? We actually are monkeys. We're classified as catarrhines. If you go to the right school, they'll actually call it monkeys. Those are the old world monkeys. This is where people belong. We are primates. We are animals by definition. If you want to say, well, I'm different from an animal, I want to say, well, you're a multicellular organism. You got an internal digestive tract. No, you're an animal. That's that's the definition, and you can't say that they're not. And when people understand how life forms are categorized, then they try to talk about, you know, well, where did all the original kinds come from? And then the whole idea of kinds just completely falls apart. And then when you look at the cattle kind, well, does the cattle kind include goats and giraffes? Because it probably should. Should it include deer? When you look at cattle, for example, I mean, cattle have so many different varieties, and they're all blended to where you've got something that is as distinct as a giraffe, and nobody would call that cattle, but you can't draw the line between it and these other things. Mm-hmm. Because most people don't realize the breadth of continuous transition that's already there. And I'm not even talking about fossil forms. I'm talking about things that are alive now. Mm-hmm. Okay, so every living thing has... at least every animal has obvious relatives, either living nearby or in the fossil record. And usually it is the case that they cannot draw a distinction between these things. As I was saying about turtles today, you can't separate the turtles from the other reptiles. You can't even separate mammals from other reptiles. If you were to look at the number of fossil therapsids and the gradations therein, again, there's no line. There's no place where you can say that these are different kinds. There's no archetype. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen, and there's no greater demonstration of evolution than phylogenetics, which is weird because nobody understands it.
I also love the demonstration you gave in the talk today, which is basically there's no such thing as a fish.
Well, I meant, of course, that the word fish doesn't have any application that makes sense. Mm-hmm. In classification, and neither does reptile, and that always throws people. Unless you redefine what reptile means in a consistent way, then it doesn't mean anything at all. Just the reptiles that we commonly call reptiles today, there are reptiles, you know, part of the definition is that they lay eggs, but we've got reptiles that don't lay eggs, so are they still reptiles? We have to come up with another definition. We make up another kind? That doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, you have to lump the categories according to all their collective traits for every member universally accepted, and then except that's what the definition is.
Aaron, thank you very much for speaking to me today. That was brilliant.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, coming up next is Hina Dadaboy. Hina Dadaboy spent her childhood in Orange County as a practicing Muslim. Since 2007, she has been an active participant in secular organizations and events in and around Southern California. She has spoken and debated as an atheist on topics such as the existence of God and the psychological impact of having grown up religious. And most recently, she's joined the writing team of Skeptic.org. Okay, so I'm talking to Hina Dadaboy, who's just recently joined the team at Skeptic, that fantastic website won by the erstwhile Little Atoms presenter, Rebecca Watson. So tell me how that came about. How did you end up writing for Skeptic?
Well, I knew about Skeptic. I was a big fan of it because I just didn't feel like there was enough feminism in the atheist movement, which shocked me because when I first left religion, I'm like, well, of course you'd be a feminist because you're not religious, but a lot of people weren't. And then I was following it and they put out a call for writers late last summer. And I said, hey, what the heck? Why not? I love writing. I have stuff to say. Let's see. And I got an email back from Rebecca saying you're in, which was incredibly exciting, and so here I am.
So you're from a Muslim background originally.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about your journey to non-belief.
As people who come from a very deeply involved religious background can probably attest, it's a long, involved process. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I like to joke, or maybe I'm channeling P.Z. Myers here, there's all these tentacles in my head that I'm not aware of, and maybe I've cut off the body, but I find tentacles intertwined in my brain all the time of religion. But it took me about 2 years to fully deconvert. It started my final year of high school. I took a class where we discussed existentialism, which really messed with my head. Because, you know, the idea that we've constructed our worldviews and our morality, sort of, no one had ever suggested this to me. And I went to a public high school here in Irvine, California. So that was interesting to find out. And then I also took a course that was all discussion and debate. And even back then, I was fairly mouthy, I guess, mouthy woman. Even Islam couldn't keep me down, I guess. And my teacher in that class is a self-identified agnostic. And he would occasionally say things to me like, you've already decided so young on how your life is going to go. How do you know where you're going to end up? And this offended me. My 16-year-old head said, well, how dare you challenge me? But it planted the seed. And then I started at university, this university, as a matter of fact. Yes, this is my alma mater. And I took my first philosophy class. And it was basically, it was called History of Medieval Philosophy. So it's essentially on the writings of Augustine, which are the foundations of the Catholic Church. And I was shocked to realize that the same arguments that Augustine used were the ones that I was taught in my Islamic classes. Because how can you have two the same arguments and somehow one ends up here, one ends up here, and they're killing each other over it? Made no sense. One of the final nails on the coffin was there was a conference, a mini conference held by this intellectual Islamic group called Alim. And they took a deconstructive approach to religion, oddly enough, but they only deconstructed to a certain point. And I remember thinking, well, if it's true, can't I deconstruct all the way and end up back in the same place? And that started the intellectual journey. And eventually, slowly, through that philosophy class, I made a friend who helped me with this. Eventually, he got me to admit I was an atheist. He's like, you're making atheistic arguments. I'm an atheist. You sound like an atheist. And I couldn't even think it, let alone say it. But he was kind of an asshole, but he got me to say it, essentially, that I was not a Muslim and I was an atheist. And slowly, the external stuff started happening. But it was all really intellectual and philosophical first. I still wore a headscarf while I was an atheist for a while because I didn't know what else to do. But then I slowly started shedding all the layers and coming out to my family and the community. And it was all very tumultuous and exciting, but here I am.
If you haven't already come across this, I'm sure you probably will, but a friend in the UK called Alam Shahar is just about to publish a book called The Young Atheist Handbook.
I'd come across it, yeah.
You have, yeah. In an article about it in the Guardian newspaper, he talked about, and I was really struck by this, that he knows lots of Muslim atheists, but most of them are sort of apathetic about doing anything about it because they just don't want to upset their parents.
Yes, absolutely. When I first became an atheist, I actually came out to everybody. I publicly came out. I put up a note on Facebook. Everybody could see it. My distant relatives, you name it. I got so many messages from people all over the world saying, you are so brave. I wish I had your guts. And I remember thinking, well, if all of you came out, it would be easier on me now, wouldn't it? But I appreciate the thought. But it's definitely true. There are plenty of closet cases, and it really is because of the strong family ties that really characterize a lot of Muslim cultures, especially Indian and Pakistani, which is my background. So, you know, when I came out to my parents, it wasn't, why don't you believe? It's, why are you doing this to us? They saw it as me trying to betray my family or my heritage or my background.
Sure.
To this day, my mother will occasionally say things like, you know, those people will never accept you. You're still one of us. You're just trying hard to be like them, but ultimately they're going to see you as brown. So
on that specific point, one of the points of my trip is I'm trying to understand the sort of context for atheists in the US as opposed to Europe. It's a completely different thing. But actually, let's talk about what's the situation for the Muslim community in the US in comparison to what it's like in Europe?
I actually have a decent standard of comparison because I lived in London for a year as a child. I lived with family out there for a year as a child. And I would say over there, they're a lot stricter. The community's far more insular. Out here, there are very few enclaves of Muslims. We meaning people who are from the Muslim community, obviously I'm not Muslim, but we live all over the place. We work in standard workplaces. Most of us go to public schools and university. Most of us get jobs. A lot of us hold really high degrees. So there's just more contact with the outside world. And so for Muslims here, it's, I mean, pre-9/11, no one knew what a Muslim was. Post-9/11, it was all sort of defensive stuff. And now it's becoming a little more textured, a little more nuanced. There's progressive Muslim movements coming out. But to be honest, the Islam here is very much, it's a lot more homogenized and mainstream. You know, yeah, you cover yourself and pray five times a day and fast, but ultimately you want the degree and the shiny car and the big house and the white picket fence and the 2.5 kids. The American dream is something that most Muslims have latched onto pretty wholesale. They're really into that. And, I mean, my dad's a perfect example of this. You know, yeah, he fasts and prays and all that, but he's worked for, of all things, a defense contractor for the past 35 years, just retired. You know, he votes Republican. He has a mortgage, which technically interest is forbidden in Islam. Because the American dream overrides certain aspects very conveniently of Islam.
And that's clearly just another example of the typical immigrant experience to the US in terms of people, you know, people become Indian Americans rather than a part of a community. But you know, after the whole 9/11 thing, there was definitely a sort of an impression that we got in Europe that the Muslim community was somehow a bit more sort of embattled and a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's why actually I've heard the idea bandied about, you know, the billboards that Dave Silverman was talking about, the pro-atheist billboards. Mm-hmm. I've heard people suggesting that we should do anti-Muslim ones. And I said, you know what? In America, that looks like picking on the wimp. Mm-hmm. You don't pick on the little guy. It would be different somewhere else. But here it's like you already have this community where people were imprisoned under the Patriot Act for no good reason. And to this day, it's still going on. You have people who lose their jobs over saying something that sounded like it might have been terrorism. You hear all these horrific stories. So this really is an embattled community. So picking on them doesn't seem so nice. But there's a lot of change going on, too. I mean, if you look at my generation, so many of my relatives have married outside of the faith. And their kids, while maybe they kind of identify as Muslim, don't necessarily know what that means. I mean, there are really religious people in my family, too, in my generation, who are raising really religious kids, but they're becoming, by and large, the minority. Mm-hmm. I'm not the only Muslim girl in my family to have worn the headscarf and given it up. Granted, I'm the only out atheist, but plenty of them went from wearing a headscarf to not. You know, it's just, it's so common. It's not even worth remarking on anymore.
That's a great point for us to end. So, Haina, thanks very much for speaking to me.
You're welcome.
Coming up next is Dave Silverman. Dave Silverman is the president of the American Atheists. He's been with this organization since 1996, holding various positions including New Jersey State Director, Communications Director, National Spokesperson, and Vice President. He hosts the Atheist Viewpoint TV program, blogs on the No God blog, has appeared on numerous public affairs and news programs, and has debated religious apologists across the country. And he was the organizer of the recent Reason Rally in Washington, D.C. Dave Silverman, thank you very much for speaking to me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're the president of the American Atheists.
Yes.
So let's talk about that organization and what it actually is and what it does.
American Atheists was founded in 1963 by Madeline Murray O'Hare, right after she basically led the fight to take forced prayer out of the public school system. And since then, we've been the Marines of the free thought movement. We are the tough guys, the bad guys. We're the ones who pick up the picket signs, raise the fists, raise our voices. We take a hardline approach to preserve the separation of church and state. We do not pretend to couch our opinion in political correctness. We state what is the case, and we stand behind our words. Religion is a scam, and God is a myth. And if that offends you to hear that religion is a scam and that, therefore, all religious believers worldwide are victims of a scam, that's too bad. It's still true.
As you phrased it in your talk earlier, you're proud to be a dick.
Well, I'm proud to be a dick with the definition the people use for me, okay? People say that atheists like me are dicks because we say what is true and because we stand behind our words. Now, quite frankly, no, I'm not a dick. I'm actually a very nice person, and most of the people in American Atheists are very nice people. But that dress does make you look fat. It doesn't make you look a little chunky around the waist. It makes you look fat. Religion is a scam, and it is a myth. And if somebody breaks the law, it's our job to stop them from breaking the law, especially when it usurps on our rights. And that doesn't make us the bad guys. It makes us the good guys. The people who are breaking the law are the bad guys, even if they're in the majority. So a lot of people say that we're dicks because we don't say, oh, you shouldn't break the law so much. You should be nicer to your children and not circumcise them. But in reality, that's all ridiculous. And it needs to be called ridiculous. And to say that religion is ridiculous is to refuse religion's demand for a respect that it does not deserve. And when you turn away that, when you say, oh, you demand respect, well, guess what? You can demand all you want. I don't respect you enough to worry about that demand. They turn around and they call me a dick. So by that definition, I'm very proud to be a dick. But in reality, I don't think of myself as a dick at all.
Part of this trip that I'm on is to look at the context in America for atheists and for science, and it contrasts very much with what it's like in the UK. And so let's spend a little time talking about what is the climate like for atheists in the US.
I'm reminded of when I first met Douglas Adams back in 1998. I interviewed him for American Atheist magazine, and I asked him, you know, has being an outed atheist ever affected you professionally? And he kind of looked at me. He didn't quite know what to do with that question because it was so foreign to him. It was a stupid question. Why would I be asking this? And it wasn't until years later, I mean, he and I kept in touch and we became friendly. And it wasn't until years later, after he moved to America, that he said to me, now I understand why you were asking me that question. So the atmosphere in America is very, very weird because the reputation is that as soon as you come out as an atheist, everybody's going to hate you. And so atheists stay in the closet for fear. For the most part, that fear is unfounded. Now, I'm not saying it's completely unfounded. There are cases all over the place. I mean, just look at the Damon Fowlers of the world, the kids who come out as atheists and get thrown out by their parents. Does happen, as pathetic and backwards as that is, it does happen. However, it's not the majority, but those extreme cases keep people in the closet. So it's in a transition. It's clearly in a transition because people are becoming more outed and they are steadily coming out as saying, oh, well, it wasn't as bad as I thought, more and more often. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're very, very timid about it because of those extreme cases. Now, a good example of this. I have been an activist since I was 30, so it was about 15 years ago now. And I've always been of the opinion, and that opinion has become stronger and stronger over the years, that the word atheist needs to be used. Because if you don't use the word atheist, if you use any other word, the person you're talking to will be able to walk away and say, well, at least he wasn't an atheist. So I have always believed strongly that the word atheist should be used, and as a result, I have always worn atheist garb, atheist shirts specifically, out in public as often as I can. And when I started doing that 15 years ago, I would get the snidest remarks, the stuff that you would expect. Mm-hmm. I got it all. And every once in a while, somebody would come up to me and say, I'm an atheist too. Every once in a while, somebody would come up and give me a thumbs up and a wink. It has completely changed now. And when I say completely changed, I'm using an absolute term. And because the change has been absolute, it has been years now since I've gotten anything negative. Mm-hmm. I wear my atheist shirts in every time I fly anywhere. If you find me in the airport, I'm wearing an atheist shirt. People do stop me. I was stuck in an airport on the way over here for 5 hours. I had four different conversations, positive conversations about atheism, including one with a very lovely 84-year-old woman who came out to me as an atheist. Nobody gives me any sort of snide remarks at all. In fact, I don't even get dirty looks.
So what's changed?
Well, I'd love to say it was me wearing my atheist shirts, but actually it's all about the internet. And there are lots of factors, tons of factors. If I were to nail it down to one, it's about the fact that nobody can claim to be alone anymore. And when I was young, I was alone. Mm-hmm. I was the only atheist I knew. And in order to find information on atheism, I had to get on my bike for 2 miles to the library and take out the one book on atheism in the whole library. Now, with my phone, I can find 100,000 atheists in a few seconds. It's impossible for a modern person to feel like they are the only atheist in the world. Mm-hmm. In fact, with just a little effort, you can find hundreds of thousands, nay, millions of people just like you. You can find every significant writing. Ingersoll's online for free. Darwin's online for free. A lot of Dawkins is online for free. And you can hear the speeches online. And you can go to YouTube and see the best there is talking. And you can still see Hitchens debates. So the number one thing, if I have to put it into one thing, and it correlates perfectly, because when 15 years ago, the internet didn't exist. Mm-hmm. There was no internet back then. At least there wasn't any substantial use. There wasn't ubiquity. But as people look on the internet, they find other people, they find strength. They're not alone. They have a base. Even if it's a virtual base, it's a base. And they can use Meetup and they can find real bases, humans. And that is what gives people the strength to be more of what they are and to be more outed simply because they don't think they're that much of an outlier.
Mm-hmm. Bearing in mind that we've already mentioned that a lot of atheists are still in the closet, so to speak.
Yeah.
What sort of percentage are we talking about? How many atheists do you estimate are in the US?
I'm going to say, if I were to give an estimate, I would say 50 to 70 million. If I were to say, okay, support that with statistics, mm-hmm. I would only be able to support 30 to 50 million. And if I were to be hit hard with definitions, it would go lower than that. The reason I used the 30 to 50 million and really the 40 to 50 million is because nuns are atheists, okay? People go way out of their way to say, oh, the nuns aren't atheists. The nuns are atheists. If they don't have an active belief in a God, they're atheists. They're us. They're not theists. They do not need or deserve or want to be counted as theists. And frankly, what they want to be counted as is not relevant. Mm-hmm. What is relevant is the fact that they don't have an active belief in a deity and are therefore atheists. If they're atheists because they've never really thought about it or they don't care enough to think about it, that's just a different kind of atheist. So if we take the terms as I define them, as everyone should define them, an atheist is a person absent of belief in God. We're talking 40 to 50 million people in this country. 40 to 50,000 are involved in the movement. So we're talking 0.1% of atheists in this country are involved in the atheist movement. Mm-hmm. That's our biggest problem.
But also potential.
Oh, it's huge. This is why American atheists, we spend a lot of money to get people jarred, mm-hmm. to get people talking. But we're not spending any money to convert theists because that's a huge thing to do. Mm-hmm. All you've got to do is attract the attention of the atheists that are out there, tell them you're out there, raise the awareness of the issues, and hope they come. If you were to try and convert people, you'd have to take a theist, convince them that they're wrong, which is a big thing, and then do exactly what we would have to do for the theist, which is tell them what the problems are and make them aware of the movement. There's no reason to do that. From an economic standpoint, there's no reason to do that. The way to get to the theists is to get the atheists out of the closet and talking to the theists on a global level so that the theists will know that the atheists are not terrible, awful, unseen people. That the atheists are people they already know and already love. Mm-hmm. And that will destroy the stereotype. That will get everybody out. And what we're seeing right now is we're seeing the snowball moving. We're seeing the snowball growing. You know, we had 30,000 people at the Reason Rally. That was beyond, really, expectations. It was beyond what we were hoping for. And that's going to translate back into 30,000 people motivated, energized, going home, using the word to their friends and to their family. And that's going to spread.
Let's just clarify that. That was going to be my last question. You were the organizer of the Reason Rally, yeah. which recently took place in Washington. I saw the short video of it today, and I wished I was there. It looked amazing. So just briefly give us a description of what it was like.
It was epic. It was an epic, epic event. My first atheist event was, again, 15 years ago. I walked into a room in Washington, D.C., and there were a couple of hundred people in that room. And I walked in, I looked around, I said, wow. Not only am I not alone, there's 200 people here. There were 30,000 people in Washington, D.C., in the rain, smiling, all the time, smiling, dancing, having a great time in the cold, in the rain, sharing ponchos, sharing umbrellas. It was a truly epic event. And what we saw from that, well, that was a huge thing in and of itself. I mean, if you can imagine the feeling that I felt, times about 15,000 or so, or 1,500. It's a huge event. It was the largest atheist event in world history by a factor of 10 in the rain, dot, 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 in the rain. And one of the most rewarding parts of it for me was the fact that all of the major national organizations were involved as equal partners. I organized it and I was the chair, but it was not an American Atheist event. It was a movement event that I ran this time, okay? And next time somebody else will run it. But what we've got from this is that, yes, indeed, not only is the movement huge, but it is organized and it is working together. It is coalescing. And no, we are not hating on each other anymore. We're not stepping on each other's toes anymore. We actually have each other's backs now. And we're rooting for each other to succeed. Because right now, all the national movements, all the national organizations are sharing 0.1% of our target market. Are we going to actually compete over another 0.1%, a 0.25%? No. We're going to look out at that huge movement, and we're going to bring all of it in. And some of it's going to go to American Atheists. Some of it will go to AHA. Some of it will go to FFRF. Some of it will go to CFI. It's all good. It's all good. It's all important. It's hard for me to really nail down what the most important part of the reason rally was, because I view that as an epically important piece. People who came to the reason rally, 30,000 of them, had individual experiences, and 30,000 individual experiences, that's great. But also important is that now we have demonstrated to the country that the atheist movement has an infrastructure that's organized and palpable and usable. And I think it's, I mean, it was a wonderful event and a wonderful time, but I also think it was a game changer in the movement. It certainly was a game changer in the movement.
Well, that's a wonderfully positive point for us to end on. So, Dave Silverman, thanks for speaking to me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
The last interview on this show is with Brian Dunning, the host of one of my very favourite podcasts. Brian Dunning produces a weekly podcast called Skeptoid. The show follows an audio essay format and is dedicated to the critical examination of pseudoscience and the paranormal. I'm sitting with Brian Dunning. Brian, thank you for talking to Little Atoms today.
Oh, it's so great to see you here.
So you're the producer and the host of a podcast called Skeptoid, which is subtitled Critical Analysis of Pop Phenomena. So, first of all, what do you mean by pop phenomena?
Well, I should also correct you. I'm also the typist for Skeptoid Media. Pop phenomena, basically anything in pop culture that a lot of people generally believe that's not true. And that includes all sorts of urban legends, religious miracles, alternative medicines, conspiracy theories, and a lot of really cool old historical stuff. Things like Jack the Ripper and stuff where there's misconceptions or holes in the public knowledge. And I always find that people love learning new stuff and learning science kind of as a secret hidden payload as part of that. And it's just a lot of fun to do.
There's a lot of skeptical podcasts. I do one myself, and there's a lot of different philosophies and styles. So I'd like to talk a little bit about, what's your approach? What do you think the philosophy is behind your show?
You know, it took me a long time to come up with that. I was probably 75 episodes into it before I really realized, okay, what is this show about? And I'm at about 310 episodes as of right now. The feedback that I get that I'm most proud of and that tells me that I'm on the right course is feedback from religious people, from believers of all sorts of the things that I talk about on the show, who say, thank you for being respectful and for covering this from a scientific perspective and not being snarky and insulting us and telling us that we're idiots. And they enjoy listening to the show. So that tells me that I'm onto something that has the potential to reach a large audience. I'm not just preaching to a choir. I think that's my driving philosophy.
I'd say myself, I'm a massive fan of the show, and I think that is its,
thank you.
Is its strength, is that it's insanely densely researched and full of information, but it's non-confrontational, and you're basically just saying, these are the facts, I can't help it, this is what I found out, make of that what you will, basically.
And you know, of course, there's also an element of storytelling that I get to go into as much as I can, depending on the subjects. My background is actually in computer science and film directing, the things I studied in school and never went into either one as a professional career in any meaningful way. But doing a science podcast is really kind of it's the perfect convergence of my interests, and it lets me do what I want to do.
So tell us a little bit about the production process for an episode. What do you do?
It largely consists of me sitting at a computer. I have accounts with just about every library and newspaper archive that you can find. Rarely I do actually have to go out and find a physical book, but you know, there's so much work. It takes an entire week to research each one of these episodes. There's so much work. I just don't have time to do nearly the kind of thorough research that it should really require by going out into the field. And it's just a matter of I usually have one, two, or three episodes I'm working on simultaneously, and one of them gets finished each week and then recorded and edited and uploaded. And that's pretty much my full-time job.
You talked a little bit about the responses, particularly from religious listeners, but let's widen that out a bit and tell me about some of the responses you get from the audience.
Two of the things that I avoid talking about on the show, very consciously, are politics and religion, because I want to appeal to the largest possible audience. However, I am willing to talk about religious factual claims made by certain religions. Notably, I've done exorcism as mm-hmm. part of what the Catholic Church believes. I've done a couple of episodes on some of the Mormon beliefs. And in every case, I've heard from people belonging to those churches who told me that they agreed with me 100%, that I was right on board, and that they really appreciated the path that I took. And sometimes I'll also do the oddball religions, like the Raelians, mm-hmm. who are, you know, kind of the naked UFO cult. And more power to them. You know, if I had to join, I'm there. but there's always something fascinating to learn. The history of the Rosicrucians, for example. Who the heck are the Rosicrucians? Almost nobody knows. But they have a really fascinating history. And that's what's just so cool about doing the Skeptoid research, is learning this stuff.
Well, you say you never mentioned politics, but I thought your recent show on the politics of climate change was, again, a really great example of the approach that you have.
That was definitely balancing on a very fine line. What I did was I tried to be absolutely equal for, here's where the conservatives can go wrong on the issue of global warming, here's where the liberals can go wrong on the issue of global warming. In fact, I went through that episode in writing with a fine-tooth comb several times, just making darn sure I was being absolutely evil-handed. I wanted to make an episode that people on the left and people on the right would both equally find logic in. They may or may not agree with it, but I wanted them to think that I treated them fairly. Didn't work out. the issue is just too politicized. You cannot say anything about it without... I got a dozen emails from people saying they'll never listen to the show again because I bought into the ideology of... It's some things are just no-win scenarios, no matter how hard you try.
And what I thought was great about that is that people will know that your own politics are... You know, you lean to the libertarian side in terms of politics. So one would expect the opposite, actually. I imagine people going into that show would have thought that, you know, you personally were going to have a certain perspective on the thing. But you end the show by saying, well, you know, the evidence points to, you know, the best science on this is done by the IPCC, and there's nothing else I can do about that.
I tried to be really clear, and I obviously wasn't clear enough, that I'm not saying the IPCC is perfect or apolitical. In fact, in the first version of the episode that was recorded and went out, the sentence was worded in such a way that I was saying the most apolitical organization is the IPCC, something like that, something worse of those effects. And I quickly went back and edited it and fixed it to say that the closest thing we have to something that's reliable, that's not being driven by politics, is the IPCC. Of course it is, though, to a large degree, but that doesn't make the science wrong. And that's where people cannot stay on board the train. If it goes against my politics, that's the end of it. I won't listen to what they have to say on science.
During this trip, I'm trying to look at skepticism and science. through the prism of a US perspective. That's sort of the point of the trip, and try and understand the difference in approaches in the UK and the US.
Are you then you're here to criticize my pronunciation of place names within the UK, right?
Yeah, we'll do. That's what we're going to do at the end. I'm going to ask you to recite a number of them, and I'll just quietly laugh towards the end of it.
I'll just say Laphroaig for each one of them.
Laphroaig.
Yes, that's my whiskey.
I want to look at skepticism from a US perspective. What reception do you get? Do you attract hostility as a skeptic beyond the subject matter of the things you're talking about? But is skepticism something that's an outlandish thing to practice in the US?
Yeah, it has a very bad name. And if I could go back in time and change the name of my show, I would call it anything other than Skeptoid. You know, I think I've got very good brand recognition now, and I think it's too late to make that change. But as soon as people hear the word skeptic, first of all, they say one of two things. They say, oh, so you're the people who believe that the government was behind 9/11, and you're the people who think that we've got aliens hidden underground. And of course, that's the opposite of what's true. And the other thing is, you're those hateful, cynical people who tell everyone that they're wrong. So it's got a very negative connotation. And that's another thing I try and do on my show is I avoid mentioning skepticism, and I've tried to avoid the word skeptic. And I talk about it more in terms of science and knowledge because that's where the value is for everyone.
Just a final point. Then you've mentioned that there are over 300 shows in the back catalogue. When are you going to run out of pop phenomena to cover? You've got a big list of things that are waiting.
I am never, ever going to run out. People send them to me way faster than I can ever keep up with. I get at least 50 episode suggestions a week. And I keep a folder of the ones that are good. And there's something like 220 in that folder right now. So that's 4 years of episodes if I get no more suggestions ever. So there's no danger of running out. And you know, I still haven't done some of the basics. I haven't done the Loch Ness Monster, for Pete's sake. I haven't really done one on Bigfoot. Some of the really basic stuff I haven't done yet. I haven't done one on UFOs. The one I did today was on the Rothschild banking family, mm-hmm. because they're just a cornerstone of so many conspiracy mm-hmm. theorists. And heck, conspiracy theory category alone, you'll never, ever run out of data. Not in the United States, anyway.
Brian Dunning, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been an honor.
Thank you. It's been great to meet you.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson, and you've just been listening to a Little Adams Road Trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny. He interviewed me. He's a cool guy. Made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAdams, and thanks for listening.